Welcome back to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. We are jumping into tariff talk. We bring on Tyler Hamm, who has years and years of experience in the toy industry, to kind of break down some of the stuff surrounding tariffs, because we're all about to enter into tariff zone and we don't know what we're going to do. If you want to support Toys on Tap, you can rate, review, like, subscribe wherever you get podcasts. If you want to jump on socials, you can follow us at Toys on Tap, all socials. And if you want to jump on and support the show even more, you can jump on Patreon, patreon.com/toysontap. It's where you're going to get extra episodes, nitty gritty, all kinds of good stuff. Now let's get back to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. What's up, man?
Hey, dude. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for making this happen.
Let me unblur the background. That's always so wonky when it's blurry.
I know. And also, that's like the super professional background instead of all the toys. What are we doing?
And there's toys all over the place.
Is there?
What are you talking about?
Oh, it just looks like books from this far away.
Yeah, no, I totally did that. I was just trying to like... You know, after my mom died, she was kind of, I've been dealing with like finishing up her estate for the past year, and she was kind of a hoarder.
Yeah.
And like, she just had so much stuff that like the thought of being surrounded by stuff, like I started to have like an allergic reaction to things.
Yeah.
So I was like, less is more for a little while, like until I get through this.
Yeah.
Because there was just so many things to go through. It was insane.
I think there's like two classifications of it. Was she the unhealthy hoarder or the like, for me, my grandmother would save like hundreds of copies of newspapers from like 1999.
Yeah, she wasn't like that kind.
Okay.
She was. And like, if you went into her house, like it, like her house was always like very like pristine, really nice.
Yeah.
Put together. But like, she was like an antique collector. Everything was precious. So like, if you go into her house, you would be like, oh, there's nothing wrong here. But like the garage is full. Every drawer is full.
Yeah.
There's, you know, she had a 25 by 10 storage unit full, then another 10 by 10 unit full. Like there was just stuff after stuff after stuff, just endless.
Yeah.
And so I started to feel suffocated by it. It was insane.
That is a lot. I mean, did it take you a full year to get through it all and rid of it and do whatever you need to do?
It's so funny that actually like this came up just now, because my brother yesterday sent me a photo of the last empty storage unit like just yesterday, and she died February before last.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So we just got out, and it was... The hardest part was like everything was like good. It wasn't just like we could have a bunch of dumpsters come up, you know. It was, I mean, I guess we could have, but like it didn't seem to be like the ethical choice.
Yeah. My grandfather had the other side of the hoarding, where it was like the healthier one, but also it was stuff, though it was okay and good, it was stuff that was still useless. Like he had at one point we counted 33 reel to reel players.
Yeah, and my mom had a box of answering machines.
Yeah, those are the funny ones. Yeah.
Yeah, like a full box of answering machines.
Yeah.
And you're just like.
And I bet you they all work. I bet you you plug them in, they'll function. I think that's the funnier, like cleaner side of hoarding that I always got a kick out of. Like you thought it was funny. Yeah.
Totally. And like hoarding like anything has a spectrum. Like,
yeah.
Just like what we do is technically like hoarding, you know, like we're buying things to hold on to them for no reason. Like they don't make us healthier or like protect us. Like of the fundamental survival things you need, like none of this shit does any of it.
Nope. And I walk in and I look at it and I say, that's cool. And then I leave my office.
That's what I do. I just like look around and I walk by and like, that makes me happy.
Yeah. And I can't even tell you why.
Yeah. And like, you know, I chose like, I don't know, like 12 vintage Star Wars figures. I think I took mostly the original 12. just like a representation, like one of my Aurora model kits.
Yeah.
You know, like a dozen or so G.I. Joes, like a box Battlecat. I wanted to call them Thundercat for some reason. And I kind of have this like little area now that's super manageable.
Yeah.
But what I kind of like is like, if I get bored with those G.I. Joes, like I go in and like shop in my own collection. Cause it's just like, they're all like packed nicely in tubs now, the rest of them.
Yeah.
Like the other 100 I had. And so I actually find it kind of lets me like appreciate them more.
Yeah.
You know, and I can swap them out and I kind of, it's like, oh, I forgot I bought this.
Yeah.
So it's like shopping for free.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. We're in it today. We're talking about something that you keep getting hate for online, and I'm currently in the midst of going through. So this is a fun little episode.
And I can't believe how much hate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean,
like
perspective.
A lot more.
Like my dad so you're getting hate, and I say perspective because like you're getting hate just because it looks like opposition against the orange guy, right? Like my dad is a full-blown Trump fiend, and I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat. I do care if you support one guy. And yeah, so my dad is like, I've brought up the fact that like I'm about to get hit with tariffs like pretty badly. And he's like, well, it's for a good cause. That's a crazy thing to say to me.
It is. And that's, you know, and it's funny when it's like hate, because while I was recording it's actually two videos I put up. While I was recording those, I wasn't trying to get political. Right. It was granted, like anytime you bring up tariffs, like tariffs are a tax. Like it's not technically like, it's just been politicized. But when I was doing those two videos, like it was just kind of an answer to when this happened, I kept seeing all these like independent, like smaller, like the one that really was like, oh, bummer, was Long Box Heroes.
Yeah.
They, you know, and they're like, we just can't do it. And I was looking through their comments and it was like, well, just make them in America. Just make them in America. Just make them in America. Like, why don't you just make them in America? And so I made that video because, actually the whole reason I started even doing these videos was because, like a lot of like film industry and toy, like influencer types, never worked in either industry, you know? And so I just thought like, hey, I've actually worked in these industries. There's clearly interest. Like I should just start giving my perspective.
Yeah.
And because of like why it ended up being two videos is because like with TikTok and Reels, you kind of have to keep under that 90-second threshold. And I didn't have time to talk about that whole like second part about China. And so where that second video is just like, does China even need us? Like in an ideal world, I could have fit all that into one.
What up, toy nerds? This is Ray.
And Dave. Go check out our brand new YouTube channel, The Toy Rats.
We make toys.
We talk about toys.
We talk about old toys.
And new toys.
And toys that we make.
And we're just a bunch of goofballs. It's a good time.
We make fun of Dave a lot.
I'm all right with that. So yeah, if you get a chance, go check out Toy Rats on YouTube. You won't be disappointed. You might be.
Yeah, you could. Who knows?
You gotta check it out.
Toy Rats. Toy Rats. YouTube.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah.
And that is the one that like took off. And so that just got kind of blasted out into the ether, I think, as like some random guy making his political opinion on Chinese tariffs when like no one, you know, because I had a bunch of people that were like, I don't know if you saw the last video I made where I was like complaining about one of the comments where the guy said, don't listen to him, he collects toys.
Yeah.
And this whole thing is about toys. Like,
yeah. I think people forget that, like, I mean, we're going to get into this, but we got to start the episode just like every time.
Yeah, let's do it.
Tell us who you are, what you do.
Okay. So my name's Tyler Hamm. I worked in the toy industry, the film industry, did a little bit of comic books, just sort of general creative all around. Now I do mostly advising, and I have my website actually is just tylerhamm.com. You can go there. You can follow. I've been doing videos, mentor. This is like the longest answer for this ever.
I love it.
But I kind of had this love of like advising and mentorship. And so I've been doing a lot of videos kind of trying to just like blab mentor to people who might be interested in either getting into toys, getting into films, or just kind of interested in kind of behind the scenes looks of how both those industries run.
Yeah. Which, and I mean, you've been on before a couple times, I think. And
yeah, this is my third time as a guest.
Yeah.
And fourth, if you include the live sale we did together.
Yeah. So you now own a part of Toys on Tap. So thank you for that stock. We're in the resin scene. You did that stuff. And you were in it really early on when some of the makers like Killer Bootlegs, before they had any deals with Super 7 or anything. And dealing with toy stuff. I mean, yeah, I watch those videos that you make. And I think how I kind of want this to go, which would help. Maybe this will help. Let me tell you my current situation, and then you tell us all about tariffs and that stuff.
Perfect.
Okay. My current situation, small potatoes for any Chinese factory, right? Anything under what, like 700 units is so small for them. And
it's hard to even get factories to do under 700 units.
Right. So I just produced one that got shipped out and I got it in time and it was 90 units, which is crazy small. They're a cool factory. And now this next one that was funded on Kickstarter, I think it's like I don't know the number off the top of my head. It's like 275 or 300 units. And because we're so early on, the mold is being made right now. And we're just kind of like, as a small person, I think early on, I decided I'm not going to pull the plug. I saw all these companies start pulling the plug in fear or whatever. And I decided I'm not going to do that yet. Nothing has really hit. I've kind of kept in contact with the factory. But on my end, no one tells me anything about tariffs. So I just know it's a tax that at some point I'm going to have to pay. The only thing the factory has disclosed is the tax that they're going to add is through DHL, and it only adds per kilogram. And I think we talked about this a little bit. I sent you a message, I think, about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so not even really like the 100% or whatever. And then we're waking up to the fact that now it's going up to 245% on certain goods. And no government official, no one is actually telling any of us what that means specifically.
Well, it's funny. And I think a lot of those companies just aren't telling anybody because even they don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to just be changing daily at kind of the drop of a hat. Yeah. Even in, so like my world of work was more adult targeted collectibles, some more higher end, like more expensive, more limited run pieces. And so many of those companies now are sending out emails where they're like, hey, like, I know you guys pre-ordered at $299 or $199. It's, they're kind of doing this we're gonna have to give us more money because now it's, you know, $299 became $449, and that's just how it's gonna be. Or they're just canceling. I saw one company that, which is funny because when I was doing collectibles, we'd always kind of had this policy of waiting until at least the product was on a boat before we'd announce pre-orders and the price. Mm-hmm. But now I've seen some companies, they're doing the same thing where instead of doing that pre-order, they're just doing this like, here it is and here's how much it cost, just because they don't know what's going on, that they're just actually just waiting for the stuff to actually get into their warehouse before even announcing it, so they at least know, haven't have a definitive price for it. And it's sort of this like, it's sort of being played off as like, hey, we don't want you to have to wait. But like, it's just because, you know, we just don't know anymore. And no one likes buying something for $200 and then finding out they owe another $150 or it's canceled or things like that. I mean, it's a bad taste in everyone's mouth.
Yeah. So maybe you can kind of walk us through at this point in this process, like they're making the mold. And I mean, we're still pretty far out from production. I'm probably at least a month out from starting production.
Yeah.
And they're pretty quick with Sufubi. So it'll take me 22 days for full production and then paint and stuff. So but no one, and I ship only by air because I've seen boat things that scare the crap out of me. No one knows anywhere. Myself, our government, them, their government, no one knows where the tax is going to hit. So walk me through this. Walk everyone through this. When is it all like, where am I going to have to pay this? Who is it to? Who's going to reach out later on in the year that says you owe us this much? Like, no one knows. So help me out.
It should be, you should be given the bill at delivery or pickup.
Okay.
And I think sometimes with air, it works a little different. I've seen, you know, honestly, I've seen some stuff kind of slip through air, but then they still do. You still might get hit with something. I mean, everything does have to go through customs technically. So it depends. There's just, God, there's so many variables, and it's so hard when it's like a universal tariff all of a sudden, because back before this, there were just layered tariffs. Like some things had a zero tariffs, or even in the toy world, it was like a scale model would have one tariff. A statue would have one tariff. If we did certain collectibles, like I actually happen to have it here. Like we did a replica of the ashtray from Creepshow, the movie. And this came in and ended up getting a 20% tariff because it's made of marble. Okay. And so it's just this like nobody knows. This is kind of unprecedented. And you can see they're kind of carving it out now. Like they just sort of made exceptions for electronics and phones, I think were one, that are now at zero tariff. I think I read the other day that automobiles are going to be at zero tariff. So what it will even be in 20 days, 22 days, like nobody knows. I know the toy industry associations are all really getting together, and a lot of the executives and higher ups at the big toy companies, like worldwide, are all getting together to try to push for a 0% tariff on toys. Because as we will probably get into and discuss later, like a 100 and 200% tariff on toys doesn't make sense, because you just can't make that up. In the back end, especially with people who say are, you know, just if you're going paycheck to paycheck, Christmas is coming up, you know, a $10 and a $15 toy suddenly become $25. Like that is deal breaking for a lot of families. And there's not enough wiggle room here with how pricing structure is done. And how like retail prices are established with wholesale prices.
Yeah.
There's just, you know, and then at the end of the day, it's what is this worth? Like, what is an action figure worth? You know, where is the stop gap where people will just say like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
And that's where the real struggle is, because even in higher end collectibles, there's a little more give, you know, if someone's going to spend, I don't know, $799 on a high-end Batman collectible, like they could probably spend $899, you know, because you're already coming out of something that's not, if you're spending that much on essentially a toy, you know, you're not counting, I mean, ideally, you're not counting on that money to feed yourself.
Yeah.
But the difference, you know, at 15 to 20 and you have two kids, you want to give them big Christmas or birthdays, but you're living paycheck to paycheck. Like that's where the real hit and struggle is with this.
Yeah. I mean, there's this cool thing where because this isn't my full-time gig, I can still do this. I think that's the harder part, that let's say tariffs hit and it doesn't come down to 245. I mean, that would be a crazy percentage, but it is the 100%. I still make a small margin on
yeah.
I can still make something, and it will fund most of my next toy as well. But I also have a full-time job on top of this. So like that doesn't impact me at all. So
yeah,
it impacts me if like this is the kind of the you brought up the toxicity that you're seeing a little bit in the comments. And so for us, we ran a Kickstarter and someone, they were pissed, right? Like it was a limited edition thing and it, like, we still have to pay for production, molds, painting, all that stuff. And they were like, why would you stop it? Like, why wouldn't you just let it go crazy? Do you not love money? And my only comment was, I don't love money. I love toys and giving people a limited edition experience that not everyone gets.
Yeah.
And they came back with, well, they tried to walk it back. Like, well, I kind of understand that, but it's not – just mouthing off. And for me, it was like, I can still do this, and you should be happy that this isn't my full-time gig because I don't have to stop. All these other companies have to stop, and I can keep going. So
yeah.
Stop. Like, it's crazy.
Well, and I think in situations like yours, that works.
Yeah.
Because say you have, I don't know anything about your numbers, yeah. And I'm just going to use round numbers just to be just easier off the top math.
Yeah. I'll like, wink at you if you're close.
Yeah, exactly. just do like the up or the down. But say you're making Sofubi and you're making them and you're getting them for $10 each. Mm-hmm. And you're going to turn around and charge $30 each. So you're going to do a 3x markup. Mm-hmm. Like there's no, you're not wholesaling. You're not doing any of that. Like if you're buying for 10, you know, and again, I'm not going to leave out all like the shipping costs. Like let's just end of the day, you get it for 10, you sell it for 30, you're making 20. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, if you're getting it for 20, because you're hit with a 100% tariff, you can still sell that for 30 mm-hmm. and still make $10, or you can sell it for 35 and make $15 because you're not doing that. You're not beholden to that 3x markup. And like most companies do more than 3x, because then all of a sudden you're getting it for 20. If you're still stuck in that 3x mindset, now it has to be 60.
Yeah.
And like for 60, it's going to be like, well, now you're turning off customers where like, you know, if it was 30 and now it's like 35, you're making a little less, they're paying a little more. Like you're probably playing in the same ballpark there mm-hmm. where that gets tricky. And, cause that was another thing I saw. It's like, well, if it just costs you $50 more to make it or whatever, just add $50 onto the retail. Like, why don't you do it that way?
Yeah.
And it's because that just comes out of wholesale. And so if you make something for $100, and you have like a 5x markup. So you're making it for 100, you're selling it for 500, you're probably giving a 40% discount for wholesale. Mm-hmm. So now you've made it for 100, so now you're selling it for 300. And in collectibles, I mean, just in all toys, generally speaking, on like a larger scale, like that wholesale is mm-hmm. where you make a majority of your money. So now instead of making $400 on this, you're making 200. So then if you have, you know, it was $100, now it's $200. You can't just eat that because now you're just making $100. And then that just becomes not worth it because a lot of these companies, it's still like employee salaries, licensing, like the licensor doesn't care,
no.
You know, but like they're still getting their percentage, you know, they're, you know, 10 to 20%.
Yeah.
And then that does include like shipping, tooling, employee paychecks, you know, if you're in an office, like rent, lights, electric, heat. So you can't just do that, you know, just add it onto the other side because that just truncates that wholesale, that like valuable wholesale part so much. I mean, there's already like, it's not a huge, whenever people hear me say like, oh, you do a 5X. A lot of times it's like, God, that's so much money. Like that's borderline, like greedy and offensive, you know, that's just, and some people do more, but that's what it takes. Cause that's also taking into account, like not everything sells out,
right?
You know, and you can run out of a license. You can have a 2-year license that after that runs out, like what you haven't sold, you have after the license expires, you have a sell-off period. And once that's done, you can't legally sell what's left over anymore. So there's those risks. There's all sorts of inherent risks. Like we've had QC issues at companies I've worked at where we've gotten the whole shipment and we've had to dump a bunch of them because there was a QC fail. So that little bit in the middle covers a lot of a toy company's just kind of just general. I mean, if you equate money to like a sense of well-being and company health. So it's hard to play with those numbers and still maintain a reasonable retail.
Yeah,
because at the end, that is it. You know, someone might pay $700 for a Jurassic Park movie prop replica, but like once you get to, there's a big psychological change that happens over $999. Cause then that's like, you're getting into like car payments, like mortgage that. So it's hard. Yeah. It's hard to push past that. And that was one of the discussions we had with every piece we made. There was the, what will we charge for this? And the second part of that is, yeah, but would anyone pay that for this?
Right.
And that's what these tariffs are just killing, because it is hard, especially now with like, as we've seen, these increased tariffs have come with a worse economy. Mm-hmm. Everything's more expensive and people are less willing to spend because no one knows what's going to happen here.
Yeah, we are in a, what I've been noticing, I think Toys on Tap is really cool in that I get to see artists from all over the toy scene. Mm-hmm. And starting it so close to COVID was cool because I got to see the inflated, where no matter what you made, someone bought it. It was awesome.
Yeah.
And then I saw it rebalance out. And in my head, I thought, oh, toys are over. But I was like told a lot, like, no, it's just going back to what it really was. And you're seeing it pull back even more, where it seems like, and I've had this conversation with a lot of people, if the economy can't support what you're asking, is it time to lower your price or stop making? Because a resin toy for $75, that is 3.75 inches, and you have like the soft vinyl toy that we just produced that's 8 inches tall and like articulated, fully painted, all that stuff. Like, how are you able to charge so much for a resin action figure? Because though I understand, after making toys, like so much work goes into it, the fan doesn't.
Yeah.
You
no one does.
Yeah.
That's actually why I had to stop doing it. The resin was giving me migraines. And so it was already like a net loss from day one. But, and I think there's also a different mindset, and this isn't like a riff on anyone or anything, but it's like, I think if you're like a single, like small apartment, maybe you have a girlfriend, maybe not, or boyfriend, whatever, like no kids, like you don't, at my phase of life, every hour I spend on something has a dollar value now.
Yeah.
And so, and I think if you're at an earlier phase of life where you don't have so many people relying on you, you can play around with that or not even think about it.
Yeah.
But, and then, so when I was doing resin figures and you're spending 2.5 hours and getting a migraine and you're getting like $40, it just became I don't even want to go to the post office for $40. Like, you know what I mean? Like 15 minutes of packing it, then something breaks in the mail. And it's just, I'd always kind of hoped that resin toys would sort of break through that novelty to art barrier. Mm-hmm. And they just kind of never did. They've always stayed in people's mind's eyes as like novelties and toys. And I'd always kind of hoped they would go a little more as little works of art, which I think people in the scene see them as, but people outside of it still see them as like kitschy.
Yeah. I think it's really tough too. And I constantly question, because there's no price guide to this, right? Like there's an artist named, I wish I knew what, I think he's still Cool Cat Toy Co. And he made, Tyler, he made the most bad toy I've ever seen in my life. Like, it's just insane. It's called, I don't know what it's called. It's a turtle. I don't know. It's a snapping turtle. It has, I think, 5 points of articulation where it's like all legs, tail, and head move. The jaw moves. And it's on the top. It's like a tank where there's two characters that go in it, and it has guns and stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
Right. It's like, it is the most kaiju thing as a resin toy, and I'm all for it.
Yeah, like a battle turtle.
Yeah, and a Cool Cat, I'm so sorry that I don't remember any of the stuff. And what I do remember, though, is it sells for $30 to $40. and it has like Glios stuff. And that is, and it's always sold out. I tried to time it. I couldn't get it. And so at this point, it's like, how do I help you make this into Sifubi giant? Like, how do we do this? Flip side, there are toys that are in backers that are like $60 or $70 that don't have as much going on. And from an outside perspective, if I was someone who was very new to the scene or someone that was walking by a table, I'm gravitating towards the turtle because it's cheaper and it does a lot more than an action figure that I can't play with because it's considered art.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me. I think it's always been hard. Super 7 produces action figures that you can play with. I produce action figures that if you touch, a little more fragile.
Yeah.
And that's really hard to reconcile, especially when mine is sometimes three times the cost of Super 7's. And so it's, that's such a hard thing. And now with tariffs and stuff on top of that, if you're getting these things made other places, like, I don't know how people are going to – DesignerCon's going to be god-awful this year if this doesn't get under control.
It's going to be interesting because it's – I haven't been to DesignerCon for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And yeah, as it's kind of trended to less of just like the homemade pieces, it might just go back to, you know, in one regard, it might go back to kind of like, I call them like the old days. Like, so you talked about when I started in resin, I think my first resin carded figure bootleg release was like 2012.
Okay.
Which is pretty early on considering like, it's not like Healy made Suck Lord early.
Yeah.
It's kind of like right after the first Killer pieces. And that's actually why I got into it, because I just saw one of Killer's pieces and I had an idea for an R2-D2 and I didn't know anything about resin. And I just shot him an email and he and I actually became really good, like to this day, really good friends. But we've kind of talked about like in the early days, it was easy to kind of categorize artists by generation. You know, it was like Healy and Suck Lord were first generation. Killer was basically a generation to himself. And then like, I would be considered like third generation. And then there was like a fourth generation after. And I think it's sort of each a generation's kind of occurs when people are inspired by the prior, you know, to start. But back then there weren't even that many artists doing it. I mean, when I started, there was just a handful, like there was a teeny little web community. And, I don't want to say like a dozen because I don't know, but I mean, there just weren't that many people doing it. Like Killer was doing it. Healy was doing it. Suck Lord was doing it. I started doing it a little bit. Like 2-Bit Hack got in there. Brandon Barker was in there, like Junk Fed. Dollar Slice came a little bit after. But it was still, and most of those guys that were doing it back then aren't doing it anymore either. Because like now there's, I mean, I would have never imagined that you could have hundreds of episodes, each one with a different artist. That's kind of in this scene. Like that's crazy. Cause I feel like it was just, it was like a micro community and now it's just like a thing. And I was hoping that's kind of goes back to that hope where it's like, God, if enough people do this, are we going to break through and have this be more of an art movement? But I mean, it still is possible.
Something that I kind of wanted to talk to you about, and I hope that people understand this too. Tell me why this can't happen in the U.S. Because I've tried to explain it to people. Like at base level, I work with students, and so they get whatever is above them from their parents down to them, and they just spew it. And so one of the students said, why don't you get, because they know what I do. And they said, why don't you have toys made in Mexico? And I said, well, I could. Mexico does have the ability to do Mexican style Sifubi, what they would, their vinyl, which I do like. I like their version of it. It's cool. It's, it is what I would do. But their country and manufacturing isn't based off of toys. It's based off of what I would call ceramics or pottery or
ceramics, like I don't want to call them linens, like like cloth goods.
Yeah.
Like, and so big time, clothing, that sort of thing.
The student couldn't understand that manufacturing doesn't mean all. And so it's right. Like Vietnam shoes and stuff. Yeah. And so it's like, so explain why we can't do that. What countries do what, and like why we can't just produce here.
Well, a lot of people don't understand that because they think back to, you know, America used to have manufacturing. You know, we had Detroit, like Detroit, the automobile capital. And I think what a lot of people don't understand that is that when that went away, there's a lot of reasons why this can't, and I'm not saying it can't ever, it just can't be done overnight.
Right.
China invests billions and billions and billions of dollars into their manufacturing factories and infrastructures and all the pipelines and supply chain there. Like they have China is a manufacturing superpower. Like the US doesn't even have that factory capability here for at least things like we need to make. I know some like medical, so there are things that are manufactured in the United States. And to kind of tip that also, which is a big part of it, is just when you're making low cost things like toys, at the end of the day, you need low cost labor to make those to justify being able to sell them for a low price point.
Mm-hmm.
And I got kind of cooked on one of my videos when I said, hey, like a toy factory worker might make $5 a day. And everyone kind of came in. They're like, oh, that's old news. No, like, you know, the average factory worker in China makes like $20 a day now.
Okay.
And but still
cheap.
But I mean, some factory workers make $40 a day. Yeah. It's just like any job. You're paid by skill. And yeah, like the average might be 20. I got that $5 a day from a factory owner who told me how much he's paying. So like that wasn't just an arbitrary number. You know, it's not, it might not be what is on Google, but let's just say $5 to $20 a day, because at the end of the day, toy assembly is a low skilled job.
Yeah.
You know, it is kind of the penultimate, what you think of a factory job. Put part A on part B, stick a screw in.
Yeah.
Next, put part A, part B, stick, or just put the paint mask on, spray your color. Next, paint mask on, spray your color. Next. And so even at, you know, $5 to $20 a day, the lowest minimum wage in the US is I think $7.50 an hour. It's $7.25 or $7.50 an hour.
And federally, that's the
lowest. So right there, you're going from $1 to $2 an hour, maybe, to $7.25 an hour. Mm-hmm. And so essentially at the end of the day, if your product just takes 1 hour of human labor, that's 4 to 7.5x markup on that cost. So, so, you know, you've already, you know, made your parts, even if it's just 20 cents worth of parts, you know, you think of like a GI Joe, just a couple little plastic greeblies. Someone takes an hour to assemble that. That being done in China, your cost after that hour is, you know, $2.
Mm-hmm.
Here you're, you know, closer to $8. And that's, you can even find people who'd be willing to go back and do $7.25 an hour factory work. And on top of that, if that would even be available, because at that level, I assume factories would just go to automation, robotics. I don't even think they would be bringing those jobs back. They would be doing factories that'd be run essentially by robots, because people wouldn't work for that little here.
Yeah.
And so that's a huge one, is just dollars per hour for production. The supply chain just isn't here. Another one that I say, I don't say this because it's a good thing, it's actually a bad thing, but EPA regulations are far tighter in the United States than there are in China, which at the long and short just means China has more freedom to pollute.
Mm-hmm.
So they can work with materials that pollute more that you can't even work with here. Like, I don't know, like vinyl. Vinyl was something like,
it's so
vinyl.
Toxic.
We interrupt this broadcast of Toys on Tap to bring you this. Meanwhile, in a galaxy of bootleg treasures.
DOV2, we have engine failure. We must crash land on DKE Toy Planet.
Oh my, we're doomed.
Wait, salvation. Hooray,
was saved in DLV2. Limited edition custom artist made action figures and DKE toys.
Check out www.dketoys.com for a full catalog.
Hooray for custom action figures.
DKE.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you couldn't make that in a legit factory in the United States because they couldn't pass EPA regulation. I'm not saying like Garage Dudes didn't do it. But like, so like United States, I don't believe. And again, this is a conversation I had a couple of years ago. Things might have changed.
Mile High is the only one I know doing this from his garage or his like shed. And it comes out great, but poor guy's breathing in some vinyl.
Yeah. But he's probably like, if there was the equivalent of a factory audit, he probably couldn't pass it.
Yeah.
And that's another thing too, where when you're working with China, which is also kind of, and I'm going all over the place here because it's a big question. Yeah. So feel free to jump in and just tell me to stop. to your point earlier where they're like, well, there's other places that manufacture, like there's like Vietnam, we have Mexico, there's India, there's other countries that manufacture, but again, they don't have that supply chain. And so like when we tried to work with Mexico, like you said, Mexico's great for like pottery, clothing. The getting the QC for collectibles was incredibly difficult. It was almost like, and again, this is my experience with it. Mm-hmm. It was almost like you were doing something illegal. It was like you had to find the liaison.
Yeah.
Like you weren't talking to the factory. You were talking to a guy who talked to the factory. And then you're like, what do you want? And he'd be like, give me your product deck. So you give it to him. And then you try to follow up. You wouldn't hear for 2 weeks. And you would just come back with like, here's the price. And it's like, well, what do I get for this? Like, and I need a QC. I need, you know, some licensors require their factories pass an audit. So it's just to avoid human rights violations.
Yeah.
And so, and that's easy to do in China because a lot of like big studios like Disney, Universal, like they have reps that can go and technically audit the factories. Like Mexico, like you don't even know what factory it is necessarily because there's this like middleman guy handling it. And then if you do go forward in production, there's no back and forth. There's no like, hey, send me pictures. It's just, this is done.
Yeah.
And you can't, and if you're doing a big run of expensive items, you can't function like that because you can't just like with Chinese manufacturing. Like I was speaking to factory owners and factory reps and US, not US based, like US like expats living over there that were like middlemanning factories. But like every day I could email, and I did nearly every day for 4 years, talk to someone at a factory in China because you're getting, you know, photos, digital photos, like, hey, how's this going? Do you have that paperwork here? Can I check to make sure your universal audit certificate is still up to date? Like, you know, very good back and forth. And you just didn't have that in Mexico. Kind of ran into the same issues in India. Like India, another place, like great with like alabaster, things like that. Great for metals. You know, like a lot of like when you see like big sword replicas, like a lot of that comes out of India. And again, though, like not great for overall collectibles, unless your collectible happens to be like a sword replica.
Yeah. I think people also need to understand a couple of things, which is crazy. Let's say we move production here. After 3 hours, everyone goes home because that's the hourly rate that I can afford. But that can't happen because people need to work. Also, my wages don't go up. So if we move production here and it costs more, I don't then all of a sudden get a boost in my pay. So I'm done buying anyways. It doesn't matter. And I think that for the China thing, I was interacting with different factories and trying to figure out who's going to produce and all that stuff. And I thank God I found one that wants to work, like wants and values low run, whatever. And just like one of the people that I had ended up talking to, I had brought up like, oh, tell me about the factory stuff. And he's like, the factory we use, the factory that we are, or like, because I guess that some factories, in order to pass the standards that Americans put on sometimes. They'll use a cleaner factory as the show one, but they will funnel it through a bad one.
Absolutely. And that's kind of like, I don't even think it's considered a secret anymore. It used to be kind of like the dirty secret there where like the factory owners get the, because kind of back when, like I've never had to go to China for this, but like you used to have to, and you go check out and they'd take the factory owner and they'd see this like beautiful showrooms. And they're like, oh, this is our factory. Like, look at how beautiful our factory is. And everyone's smiling and they're all in clean clothes. And, you know, and it's like, that's the factory. That's the feel good about hiring this factory.
Mm-hmm.
And then the factory actually doing production in the is back. 40 miles further inland with much different standards of kind of everything. And I honestly feel like that's kind of where part of that like $5 to $20 is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That like there's like the $5 factories, you know, which are basically in farmland. Like we had, I don't know. And again, I don't want to pretend I understand the ins and outs of the Chinese economy or how that works. But I know that China has always been incredibly manufacturing heavy. And if people want to start a factory, the government is very likely to give you the money to start your own factory. And like when Chinese New Year would happen, I've had this happen.
Oh, your production stops.
Well, but this here, I've had this happen. I've just had this happen twice in my experience. And the fact that it happened two times is kind of nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have a run in a factory, they're like, Chinese New Year, talk to you in a month. Then in a month, you talk to those people at the factory or your rep, and your rep goes, we have to turn the job down because everyone left. They went home to their villages, like villages, you know, that's not my term. I'm not being like, I'm making an assumption. Yeah. That's how it's said to us. They go back to the village and the workers get together and decide to start their own factory.
Yeah.
And the government funds it. And now all of a sudden, all those employees have started their own factory, and the factory they were working at now has no one to work there anymore.
Yeah.
And so I know like they're very, very forward thinking with, you know, and again, I don't want to get the ins and outs of how it's like, so that's another thing people were saying all over. They're like, oh, it's a false economy based on like, I don't know. I'm not an economist. I work in the toy and film industry.
I think if people want to know the economy side of it, Peter Zion is a really good geopolitical and economist for world politics and how countries function. And for all that, I mean, he, of course, everyone has said some kind of crazy stuff, but for all the stuff that he has said, he was very clear on the type of government that China is and what we can never be. China is able to pivot an entire people to do whatever they ask. The only time that we can do that, and we have done it, is during wartime, and we can only pivot towards war materials.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard for me to understand. I think going back to the like the Toys on Tap side of it, I like working with Paul from Mile High because I like Paul.
Yeah.
Paul is not the cheapest person to work with, but because I have a relationship with him and because I see him at Designer Con and because he makes me laugh and like I have toys, I will happily pay his prices to work with him. I don't give a crap if my thing says Made in America on it. That doesn't matter to me at all, because I can tell you that the molds that he pulls my toys out of still come from China.
And that was another issue with bringing manufacturing here, because so much still has to be sourced from China anyway.
Yeah.
Like it's not just all of a sudden we can make every part here.
Right.
And it's funny that you mentioned the Made in America thing too, because that was another thing I kept seeing.
Yeah.
People are like, I'd happily pay a couple more bucks for something made in America. Great. I'd pay a few more dollars for something made in America. And it's not a few more dollars. It's a lot more dollars. And they did a big retail study years ago where they kind of, and it was big. And I wish I hate speaking like this is factual without a footnote. I just can't recall who did this study.
Yeah.
But it was very big. And when they started asking people, you know, like, hey, if something, if a product is not tested on animals, like, would you pay more for it? And everyone's like, of course I would, you know, mm-hmm. and if this product's, you know, eco-friendly, will you pay more for it? Like, totally. If this product's made in America, will you pay more for it? Yeah. And all these people, you know, just almost 100% are like, of course I would, of course I would, of course I would. And then on the flip side, when they start analyzing these people's purchasing, they're all just buying what's cheapest. Mm-hmm. So it's so easy to just say, you know, like, I'm going to stand on this moral high ground. You know, I'm going to pay, you know, if my $10 whatever costs $11, but it's made in America, I'll buy it. And yeah, maybe if it was a dollar more, yeah, people would. But when it's $10 more,
yeah,
like, I just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the hard part is I can disprove that people would pay extra money very quickly. The second that McDonald's went away from their dollar menu, there was an uproar. The second that our gas has gone up $1, there's an uproar. Like, a dollar is so incremental that people have an uproar over that. This is about to be catastrophic. And
yeah, this isn't just a dollar. And I don't think – I think people still kind of think, you know, oh, you know, if it's 12 bucks, like 13 bucks is no big deal.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's kind of true. But
and I'm guilty.
$13 and then having it be $13 more is a huge deal.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting is everyone tries to have the mindset of billionaire elites. Like, oh, I can pay, like, I can cover a little extra. Mm-hmm. Eggs went up to $7 and I stopped eating eggs.
It's insane.
And that isn't even based on the economy. That's just based off of like shortages and stuff. I stopped. Like, I now no longer add that to my diet because it pissed me off. I went to vegan eggs because they were cheaper.
Restaurants in town here, you know, because eggs aren't just eggs. They're in things. And, you know, there's a restaurant owner I love here that owns it's like a bagel falafel shop. Yeah. And she on her Instagram is very transparent. And she's like, hey, prices are going up. This is why. And it's like, here's what 500 eggs cost last year. Mm-hmm. Here's what 500 eggs cost now. And it's just this exponentially larger number.
Yeah.
And this is, again, she's buying wholesale too and in bulk. And you're just like, oh my God. Yeah. And it is. And it's like those little, like, $1 at a time doesn't hit you until all of a sudden you sit back and realize, like, oh, that little dollar is now $6.
Yeah.
Some of those toy companies started doing that.
Yeah.
Kind of during COVID, where they kind of, it was easy to blame.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, oh, you know, our $12 action figure, our $9.99 action figure is now $12.99 or $11.99. And then no one really complained. And then suddenly they bumped it up to $13.99 and kind of no one complained. And they kind of hit 14. And then there were some little grumbles. And so it took a while before they went to 15. Mm-hmm. But, you don't notice as it's slowly happening until all of a sudden you realize it, like, over the course of 2 years, your $9 action figure is now $15.99. And you're like, well, it's the same thing, you know? And in some cases there's even less, like Marvel Legends is kind of coming under fire for that, 'cause the new figures cost more and they don't have the extra hands and things. And so you're getting less or more.
Yeah. I thought I did. There's a couple things, like, on old Street Sharks, massive figures.
Those were chunky figures.
Like $297.
Yeah.
Which, insane. I mean, that's a crazy thing anyways. And now you have something like Super 7, which, no shade, I love what Brian's doing, and I love that company. $20 for 375, which – I mean, it is what it is. Like, you can't get around it anymore, but they're at the high end. And there's no – the company that I am really wanting to keep an eye on, and I think will really dictate how bad this is, there's a – I don't know who makes it. I can't identify the company, the factory. I don't know who does this. At Dollar Tree, there's a action figure line called Final Faction.
I love Final Faction. I thought that was the smartest. In fact, I didn't post it anywhere. I wrote a big write up about them.
Yeah.
On my LinkedIn profile, because it was just titled "Final Faction Could Save the Toy Industry."
Yeah, they, for $1.25, good guys, bad guys, accessories, vehicles,
accessory packs.
Yeah, fully articulated.
Yeah.
And
comics, like a kind of like not a great cartoon, but yeah, like it has a cartoon.
And not to be misconstrued with He-Man, where they're reusing parts, yeah, all the figures are different. And even the aliens barely use each other's things because they're so different. And they can still stay for $1.25. So there's something to be learned here that somehow they're able to do all this stuff for $1.25 and make their figures that still have relatively good paint apps for what they are.
The paint apps are – they're obviously simplified.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they're good. And, like, I bought the full original line when they came out just out of curiosity. Mm-hmm. Like, what are these? You know, how can – and why are they $1.25? Yeah. And they're good figures. The sculpts are all great. I mean, I've always said that. Like, it really doesn't cost any more to have a good sculpted figure than a bad sculpted figure. I mean, a lot of times when a figure looks bad, that's in the paint apps. That's actually not in the bare sculpt. Mm-hmm. And I actually have one of those. I was so impressed by the sculpts that I reached out to I found the sculptor on LinkedIn, and I reached out to him, and I had him send, I bought one of the figures directly from him and asked him to autograph it.
Empire Blister. Empire Blisters. Specializing in action figure blisters. 2.75 inch or 1/18 scale. 19 different styles. Two sizes of clamshell figure cases. Four different bulk pack options. Quantities of 100 sample packs available. Empire Blisters.
Now functional. Toys on Tap.
That means a 10% off coupon on checkout. Use code Toys on Tap 10. That's TOYSOMTAP 10.
Empire Blisters. Empire Blisters.
Because he had just done this guy had conceptualized the entire line.
Can you send that info to me so I can interview him?
I will. And God, I wish I could remember his name right now.
Yeah.
But it like the whole line was his idea. If I'm butchering the story, I'm sorry. I think he was working at an agency that had it's some affiliation with Dollar Tree. I can't remember what it was. And Dollar Tree came to the agency and was kind of had this, we want to make a low budget action figure line. And he kind of created the whole thing, including sculpting. So he would be a great guest. I'll try to find his info on there.
Yeah.
I just can't remember his name off the top of my head.
If that goes up in price, things have shifted. That's kind of how I'm gauging certain things. Like I'm looking at the bare minimum ones, like the lowest level. If they start going up, that means everything's about to go. Cause they can't, if they can't find it cheap, how are we going to find it cheap?
Well, they won't. Well, and also it's so cheap because it's, you know, there's no license. They own the license. The card backs are small. I don't think they're making a ton of money on these things.
Yeah.
As with a lot of Dollar Tree things, you know, Dollar Tree's not making 3X. They're probably making, you know, 20 cents on each sale. They kind of go in bulk and they might have made 100,000 of them.
Yeah.
But that's where I also get incredibly confused by some of this because, and again, like we talked before, this has become so politicized. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like to keep politics my last video got political because it was taken very out of context and everyone just watched the part two without the part one,
yeah,
or at least the part two is the one that got 60,000 TikTok views. But with guys like Trump, like two of Trump's biggest supporters, I think, and again, like I might be wrong here, I believe two of Trump's biggest supporters financially were the CEO of Hobby Lobby and the CEO of Home Depot, which and die based on
imports,
Chinese manufactured imports, especially Hobby Lobby,
mm-hmm,
which is why I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing a tariff cut out for things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't know. I mean, that's just me theorizing because I can't imagine. I mean, even the CEO, I think the CEO of Home Depot came out publicly the other day and was like, you know, these are industry killers.
Yeah.
So I don't understand. And I do understand the thought process, which is what you're hearing, where it's like, bring American job and American manufacturing jobs back.
Yeah.
But like you need, that's a 10, 15 year plan.
Yeah.
That's not a surprise, you know, starting tomorrow. everything's going to cost twice as much.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure it could be done. I mean, you need aggressive subsidies. It would be so highly automated. I don't even know how many jobs would come back. There's an American stigma still about factory jobs, whereas like a factory job in China is like an honorable job where you can take care of your family. It's a totally different mindset. Being a factory worker there isn't what Americans think of as factory workers here. And so, I mean, you get people who won't take a job at McDonald's when, you know, McDonald's is struggling to hire people for $17 an hour.
Yeah.
You know, because there's that, like, I'm not going to work at McDonald's mentality. Like, imagine being, you know, so if people aren't going to work at McDonald's for 17 bucks an hour, who's going to work in a factory for seven?
Yeah. And I think it's so like, I've worked in a warehouse before. When I came home from college one summer, I worked in an e-recycling plant, and which is awful. Like, you are in front of a conveyor belt separating all the parts and transistors and alloy, like anything that got there, you were separating and then cutting the bags and doing all that stuff. It met regulation, but there were signs everywhere that you're going to get cancer. And there were signs everywhere that were like, you need this kind of equipment, and signs everywhere about like, hey, this is a 12-hour shift. You're asking people to do things that we just don't do. And that's fine. I mean, what is very scary, and this is just projecting long where this is headed. There are in like Florida, they're trying to get the age so you can work younger.
Yes. That's so, another thing that's been coming up a lot is, you know, people are kind of saying, you know, welcome to a return to child labor.
Right. So nth degree, you say that that's okay, but then you got to find the kids. So the first place you look are the troubled kids in like group homes or foster care.
Yeah.
And you say, oh, if you come work here, we'll give you housing or we'll help you do this. And it's just a way to pay them less and keep them from making something of themselves and using them as a stepping stool. And I know that that may seem like a big jump, but putting tariffs and doing what we're doing worldwide also seemed like a big jump, and we did it.
Yeah.
So we're in the business of making big jumps right now.
Well, I think too, a lot of people think back to like the Henry Ford factory days.
Yeah.
Where it was like, you got your, you know, the 40-hour work week was a Henry Ford invention, because he kind of, he, you know, the and I, again, like, I don't know the ins and outs of this, but the theory was 8 hours of work, 8 hours of recreation, 8 hours of sleep. And Henry Ford would buy towns around factories, make housing around factories, and you'd have this like short walk to work, short drive to work, do your factory job. Back then there was like retirement plans. There was, you know, you could work at the factory every day for 40 years and theoretically know you're going to retire at 60 or whatever with, you know, X amount in your savings account, and you're never going to have to worry about running out of money. You're not going to, and there was that whole, like, that's what they kind of called like the American dream, you know, like the golden age of America, that like chicken in every pot, car in every garage thing. But like, that's not going to happen with $7 an hour factory jobs now.
No.
And you can't, and on the flip side, like we're talking with China, you can't have, you can, not with the stuff we're talking about, $50 an hour factory jobs. You can't have someone getting paid $50 an hour, you know, $100,000 a year, good salary, you know, assembling GoBots.
Right.
You know, so it's, there's no solution I could think of where this works for this type of manufacturing.
Right.
I mean, unless this is just the end of the toy industry as we know it anyway, which is another possibility, you know, I mean,
yeah, I think toys are dying.
Kids are buying less toys, you know, toys are, you know, every year you go up in multiples at what percentage of people are buying toys. And, you know, it used to be 90% kids, 10% adults, not long ago, then 20% adults, then 25% adults. Now it's like 40% adults. I mean, the only toys my kids like are Legos. Right. You know, there isn't action figures. You know, I think Legos, video games, and I think, you know, video games are all distributed digitally for the most part now anyway.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, we're just in this, the only way that I can see this working well, and this, it sounds so calloused and I'm hoping that it doesn't go this route. I mean, we're really good at imprisoning people in the US and it's just a small leap to make them do factory work. And then it's just another small leap to become a main exporter of something that we can produce with low labor. I mean, we do this already with having prisoners or inmates fight wildfires in California. I don't know if it's nationwide, but we do that here.
Yeah.
And they pay them like two something an hour. It's wild.
It's funny. I actually read I read an interesting thing about that. Yeah. When the last series of California fires were going on. And it was interesting hearing the inmates talk about that. Cause I think it was like I think you get I think an average inmate makes something like 35 cents an hour. Mm-hmm. You know, like for work or 30 cents an hour. So I think the firefighters get, it's like almost 10 times more.
Mm-hmm.
They get better food, they get better shelter. Like they're not necessarily in the same type of prison, but you have those qualifications. Like there's certain crimes that you cannot have done, you know, that keep you there. And I remember a lot of those guys were pretty stoked about getting able to do that, because it also kind of lends them into this plan where, you know, you get out of prison, you know, you can become a free firefighter.
Yeah.
You know, you're not a prison firefighter. You're just a firefighter. And it's an interesting take with prison labor. I mean, I think honestly, the only solution is sort of what the toy industry is pushing for with that zero tariff, zero toy import export tariff. Because we decided a long time ago as a country, like we would just rather have really cheap. And that's when everything started kind of going overseas.
Yeah.
And there's no way to really unring that at this point. You know, you can have sort of, you know, you go to farmers markets and, you know, you see people who are selling their like artisanal wooden train sets and things like that.
And I don't buy it.
You don't buy it. And it's, well, because they're kind of expensive, but like they're cool and you're making it by hand. You know, there's like wooden toys and things. But another thing a lot of people don't realize is that, like, you know, licenses sell toys for the most part. And when you have a license, as a toy manufacturer, you need a specific set amount of insurance. So if that toy breaks, or some, you know, God forbid a kid chokes on a part, you know, the arm breaks off and the plastic's sharp and the kid gets cut, something like that happens, you need X amount of dollars coverage to protect yourself from those lawsuits and to protect the licensor for those lawsuits.
Yeah.
And that insurance is insanely hard to get and it's crazy expensive. So like a small toy maker, even in the United States, who wanted to do, you know, Disney, Universal, Warner Brothers, Sony products, I mean, they're already going to have a hard enough time without paying five figures a year just for their insurance policy on top of it. I mean, they're super expensive. There's a lot of weird little things like that. That I don't think a lot of people kind of outside and like, why would you know that? But there's so many little things that way. And even to kind of kick back to something you said earlier, and this was the topic of the video that kind of went crazy. You'd said you're so grateful that you found a factory in China who is willing to work with you. Post COVID, I started noticing less factories being willing to work for at least us. And I asked some owners and some liaisons I knew, and they all had sort of agreed. They said, yeah, China's middle class is growing. And a lot of factories that used to have to take foreign jobs are now just producing for China's middle class. And so there's in some circumstances, they don't even need us for this.
Yeah.
You know, their middle class is growing. Their middle class is 700 million people now. And it was just a fraction of that in 2020 in 2000. So over the past 25 years, their middle class has gone from like almost none to about half their country. And granted, economically, China's middle class is different than ours. I don't know what the U.S. equivalent for a middle class life is. I, I read somewhere, you know, middle class in China might be $18,000 a year, but it is growing. I mean, it, you know, imagine going from, you know, not zero, but zero to 700 million in 25 years. Like look yeah. at 25 more years. And so that's another kind of kink in this where they're kind of, everyone's kind of in this standoff. Mm-hmm. And there is part of me that's kind of worried, like maybe China doesn't even, at least not right now, you know, they're starting to not even need to manufacture like mm-hmm. little cheap things for us.
Yeah.
So then what's next? So then we get the best case scenario, which is just a zero tariff on toys. But yeah. what if China then says like, nah, no, you still have 100% tariff. You know, like yeah. what if they start the strong arming?
Yeah, and like I think
then it's just like okay, there's no way around that.
I think we're in a bind. You know, the tariff thing, that's a bummer and that sucks, but it shows a different bind that we're about to be in, that the collectible market in Asia, in Asian countries, is massive. Like
huge.
And they collect so much more. And you know, I've heard over and over again that the reason why Sifubi is packaged in a bag and a header is because there might not be that much space in Japan on their shelves or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. The more I talk to people that go to Japan and the more that I talk to people that are in Japan, I call BS. What I think is happening is we are just stuck in a traditional way, which is fine.
Yeah.
But I think that they're going to get to a point where their market for collectibles is so big that they don't want to engage with this, which is going to shrink our side. And the only toy creators that are going to function, like the toy that we just just started and Kickstarter did whatever, is a mashup mm-hmm. between two massive IPs.
Yeah.
And so it brings up nostalgia and the sculptor is great. So it's like, this is awesome. And the paint apps are going to, so
that's a great figure. You're talking about the Stay Puft Crank.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that is a gorgeous, cool figure. And like, what a fun tribute to.
Yeah. And we're pumped.
Everything 80s.
And I think that is going to be the type of toy that will survive. If your toy coming out doesn't tickle the back of the brains of the vintage collectors, it will not sell anymore, because no longer, like if prices all end up going up, we're not going to pay for original IP. Then I want something that I know and love.
Yeah. Something proven.
Yeah. And so it is a very scary, I help artists bring their toys to life, but the new conversation I have to start having with them is, if you can't sell 100 pieces, I can't make a toy with you. And I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Because the flip side is, even though I can sell something for super cheap, like I made a little Chum Shark figure and I was able to sell each one for $24. Mm-hmm. There is a question of, did I undercut the toy economy? Did I undercut people that just aren't set up the way that I am and that this is their full-time gig? Potentially. And that's a bummer. And I didn't mean to, but I just have a different opportunity before me.
Well, that's kind of how the whole resin bootleg thing started.
Yeah.
None of those are original IPs. It's just pieces of different things you remember put together. Mm-hmm. And they kind of tickle this nostalgia bone, and then someone buys it because like, how funny. That's, you know, Han Solo frozen in a Pop-Tart. Like I love Han Solo. I love Pop-Tarts. Like I'm going to buy this.
Yeah.
You know, but then a lot of original IPs just never... I can't think of many that original IPs that resin guys created that were ever, you know, even like guys like Sucklord, who kind of created his in universe.
Yeah.
But it's all still parts, you know, it's all still parts that were taken from here and there. So,
there's one I know of right now.
Brandon Barker did a good job with his Warlords of War.
They're kind of
those He-Man inspired. I'd say that'd be about as close, because he actually ran with those. Yeah. And those are awesome.
9 to 5. Yeah. Brandon.
What a fun idea.
Yeah. Brandon did it. And he has this, I will tell you, like it comes apart, like fun chip things, mm-hmm. and you can tell he grew up in the 90s. I think the issue that he's having still, even though these are incredible sculpts and incredible toys, is if it was something that people knew and a toy line that people knew, they would buy more.
Yeah.
And we just don't have the economy anymore to say, we want to produce a toy line that also has a show and a comic, and that doesn't exist anymore. Like, and so what do we do?
The barrier to entry is too high.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to start a toy line and start a comic and a series, you know, A, your series is going to end up on like probably YouTube. You're going to spend a fortune making something. It'll end up on YouTube. It'll have to be an indie done comic. You're paying for, you know, I don't know many artists that have $100,000 they can gamble on their idea.
No. It's crazy. And even, I think that's why, if I had to be honest, I think that's why some artists moved to Sifubi. Mm-hmm. The mold that's cost funny. Is so cheap, which in comparison, right? So we're doing the molds and stuff. And I've talked to Brandon, who made 9 to 5 Warriors. And mm-hmm. we were talking mold cost, because I got a quote from another factory to help bring someone else's toy. And because it is ABS or whatever type of plastic, it was $8,800 for the mold. And that is on top of production and on top of boxes. And I was like, I don't know that I can help you. Like, I have money, but I don't have $8,800 to give you for a toy that is not tested.
Well, and sometimes, like, that was always the big shock in collectibles, just waiting. Like, what's the mold going to cost?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, some of these big ship replicas, Star Wars ship, you know, that'd be $80,000 in tooling. You're just like, oh my God. So that's $80,000, just your $80,000 in before you've made anything.
Yeah.
Like not, that's like, it's not even including like the resin and the plastic and or the paint or the big cardboard box. I mean, that's when you kind of, that's a big part of when you decide what you can go forward with. You know, I have the greatest idea ever. I think it's super cool. You just get smacked with this insane fee for tooling. Yeah. It's like, well, you know, you're only going to make 1,000 of these, and that added $80 per unit. So
this better be a good toy. Like and then telling him like Sifubi molds, even at the most expensive, are a couple grand. Like, significantly mm-hmm. cheaper, and they're made in small runs, so you can make that money back quicker if your toy is good. I think that's what we're also boiling down to. This is, I started in COVID, and so 2020, honestly, those toys that I made during 2020, I wish I could get them back and say, like, I'm so sorry for producing these. This is not what I should have been producing. You bought it. Mm-hmm. You supported my early years. Thank you. It was kind of this weird thing where it didn't matter what I produced, but it ended up selling, which was awesome.
Yeah.
We're about to approach that. If it's not good and seen as good, whatever the hell that means for a toy, if it's not seen as good, it's not going anywhere.
Well, when it was a smaller community, that was kind of part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't just buying the toy, you were supporting the artist.
Yeah.
And I remember not buying toys I liked because I thought I didn't particularly like the artist.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't like their personality. I didn't like their, there's a lot of personalities
in
resin, you know, but then I would buy a worse, you know, figuratively worse executed figure.
Yeah.
From someone I just thought was super cool. You know, it was more about that kind of direct support of the artist, not necessarily as much like this thing has to be perfect.
Yeah.
And so I think that was a big, and that's what kind of made this feel like a community. And then again, it just got gigantic.
Yeah. And we're just, I don't know. I think the move, I don't, the problem is too, is I speak out of turn because like I haven't been around long enough to really see how this is going to play out. I think DesignerCon moving is going to impact things again. The amount of people that can go. Like, the artists that come from overseas to table at DesignerCon, they're going to do pretty dang well because they get to bring their product with them, sell, and go back, which is awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be like just an instant discount. And
yeah,
but I mean, designer cons, like any con, you know, it is a business.
Yeah.
When I used to go to designer con, it was just artists. Like there wasn't, you know, I don't know if Funko sets up it, you know, but they might as well. You know,
Pop Mart now is the big one.
Yeah. And you got companies like Super 7 are going to designer con. It's sort of kind of just shifted its whole aura. And from a business perspective, I get that, you know, if you can sell a table for $1,000 versus $75, back in the early days, God, I can't even remember how much the early designer con tables were.
I can tell you how much they are now.
Yeah, they were like under, I want to say they were like $100 maybe.
Oh, it is. I just paid for half of a booth and I think I paid $650, $550. They're not cheap.
No, but I mean, because they have a totally different clientele. I mean, they're moving to probably a space that can get them even more people, kind of more hotels around it, more tables in the room.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, it'll be interesting to see sort of the evolution of that. And I kind of wonder if someone else will pick up like the creator only aspect of it. You know, is there room for another old school designer con, or is that just,
I think collected con is trying to right now, in Chicago, I think it is. They're trying to, I know that like G Fest in, I think Chicago or Illinois somewhere, is doing that with like Godzilla stuff. So it's like more artist styled.
Yeah.
And they're huge. I think that you have all these little shows that I don't know what they are. Like Kaijufornia is a Sifubi only show at a brewery in Southern California. Robo Toy.
Oh, that's cool. See, we don't have that where I moved to now. We have plenty of breweries, but there's no toy scene here. There's like a creator, you know, it's more like farmers markets type creator fairs, you know, but it's a lot of art prints.
Are you up?
A lot of like stickers. Oregon? I'm in Oregon now. Yeah. But not like in Portland. I'm in Central Oregon. And so it's more artisanal, you know, like candles and things like that. Like there's no, I don't even know. It would almost be worth doing it and just buying a table and putting a bunch of resin figures out there to even see what people would think.
Yeah.
You know, it's just such not, it's so off the radar.
They would see the prices and panic. And I've had artists come on and say like, oh, I have almost no sales now. And it's like resin toys are getting hit because they are at a high price point for people that don't see it as art yet. And that's a tough sell.
There's my favorite toy artist, and he's become a friend over the years. And he's very unknown in like this designer toy scene. His name is Randy Regeer.
Mm-hmm.
And he, there aren't words I can tell you right now to express how perfect his work is.
Yeah.
He's just one of those guys that can create a narrative and a story and make something. And his is more stories of the past.
Yeah.
So he can make an action, not even an action figure, but like a play set or a vehicle or something. And just say like, hey, there's a barn find of these, you know, the only one left, you know, is left in this barn in 1952. And it's aged, and it is just perfection. It is just perfection in an object for what it is. And he has always told me, he's like, I don't sell a ton of my work because I price it like it's art.
Yeah.
And it's such a simple statement, but it is so perfect. Like he's like, I you know, and when he does sell it, they sell for art prices. But that's just his whole thing. He just is, I sell these, I price them like they're art because that's what they are. And they are. They're beautiful. They're in museums. They're in just the highest of high-end personal collections.
Yeah.
That's hard to do. That's hard to do.
Yeah.
Because with his works too, they can be big and they're metal and they're, you know, like I happen to, this isn't one of Randy's, but like this is a 30s.
Oh yeah.
Toy car, you know, like it's big, it's metal. It has perceived value because of the materials it is. Mm. It has, you know, some rust spots, age, everything like that. That's hard to do. when you're 3 3/4 inches and kind of sometimes crudely painted, and to your point, not that much different from all the stuff you're seeing on the racks at Target for $10 to $20.
Yeah, I think that's why I enjoy Sifubi at this point. Not more, but a lot. Because like it, there's a different perception that goes with it of what it can be charged or like what you can do with it and versus what I can get produced. And I don't know. I think toys.
So Fubi always had kind of an aura about it though.
Yeah.
You know, like in like the designer toy scene, that was kind of like a goal. There was a, this make a So Fubi goal.
Yeah.
It kind of had this, almost like you've graduated to it. Like you've made a Sifubi and you're not just like a, you're not just like a resin slinger or a kit basher. You have a Sifubi now, you know, you've crossed over into, I guess technically you've crossed over into factory production is kind of at the long and short of it as well.
Cause that's the quickest way to get to, I think that, and, man, there was one other one, maybe it's a resin statue. Because those are pretty like inexpensive because there's no moving parts. And I think those are the probably most inexpensive to get into some type of where you can claim it's factory produced, it seems.
Yeah. And they put a fan, they call it polystone. And
yeah. And so it's like
other thing.
It doesn't. I mean, I don't know. We're getting to a point where like. I just started this production thing with other artists and I'm already now getting to a point where it's like, if toy sales drop too much, I don't know what to do. Like if I got lucky on the first one, I think, and I traded in social capital and worked with an artist that people liked and got really lucky and we sold like 100 and something of them, but it hit that like price point and it hit the side, like I got lucky, I think.
Yeah.
And then, I'm just nervous that I can't keep getting lucky. Right. Like there's going to be a shortfall somewhere.
Well, I found too, like in the position you're in where you're doing production with people, that is incredibly stressful because you are shouldering a huge amount of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I did that. After I went and I left the toy industry last year, I had a friend. It's funny, I've never actually met him, like an Instagram friend, guy named Dave Woodman, who's fascinating. He's a classic Disney animator. Like he was an animator for like Aladdin, The Lion King, The Little Mermaid. Like he was an animator for all. And one of the other things he did was if you watch National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation,
the opener,
there's that animated intro.
Awesome.
Yeah. So he was the artist, one of the artists on that intro, and he was going to make a Christmas ornament of the Santa. And I saw him going through this process kind of on Instagram, and he was just talking about like, God, he's like, these are, you know, they're kind of expensive. He's getting them all 3D printed and paint them himself. And
yeah,
he's saying like, oh my God, this is so much work. And so I said, you know, why don't you just go factory route with these? And he didn't know how. And I just being a friend, I was like, here, let me help you with that. So I made a product book. I reached out to one of the factories that I knew and I worked with consistently. I reached out to my rep there. They agreed to do a low run, just kind of as a favor. And good price. We just went forward. And oh, God, like so stressful just for me. Because like I kept getting the QC emails like this paint's wrong, and it was just like, you know, they got loaded up to be shipped over. Are they all going to get here? Are they going to be broken? Is there going to be any weird fees that we didn't think of? I just had shouldered all of this responsibility for something that I was just doing for free to help him out, just as a friendly favor. And they turned out great, but I was sweating that so hard. I was sweating it like I was sweating these like $100,000 runs that we were doing in professional in my toy life. Mm-hmm. You know, it was that same like, ah, oh my God, because again, like on a smaller scale producer, you know, if you're, you know, you have this $100,000 run and So I misspelled something on a box once. Mm-hmm. We're doing packaging for a collectible, and I misspelled the collectible's name on the box. And like, I didn't catch it. The licensor didn't catch it. No one caught it until we saw the samples. And we're like, that's not how you spell that. Mm-hmm. And so we had to get the boxes reprinted. And it was like $700.
Yeah.
And so it was like $700 on top of a, you know, $20,000-$30,000 run, you know, not a big deal. But like $700 on top of like a $700 run.
Yeah. You'll kill me.
It's like traumatic. It just kills the whole thing. And then like, I've let down a friend. I've let down, you know, it was just so much responsibility. Where someone asked me to do it afterwards, they're like, "Hey, can you help me do this again?" I was just like, "I can't, dude. Can't. Like, I would have to charge to do it."
Yeah.
And like, and I don't want to do that. And it would have to be so, like, my anxiety level is worth so much money to me. Like, I would have to charge too much to make myself be able to feel okay about this, to make it worth the stress. That I just couldn't do it.
I think the harder part is like, communication, right? That's the big thing for me. So transparency, I'm transparent with the artist the whole way. But it's me who has to stay up late because China's on the opposite end of the world.
Yep.
And I'm working with the current artist who is in France. And again, we get like a brief period during the day where we can talk. And that's in the midst of doing both of our normal day-to-day jobs. So we're like doing things at each job, plus trying to communicate over Instagram and send things and do things. And then you add a Kickstarter on top of that. And we're trying to go back and forth. Like every time there's a proto made, do we have it sent here? It's going to cost us like $150, but do we have it sent here so that we don't have to look at pictures and we can actually say,
yeah.
I don't know.
I would say yes.
Yeah.
I've always, you know, there's people who've done a lot more collectibles than I have, but I think I'm probably in the hundreds of collectibles. I've either art directed or sculpted or creative directed or had some part to play in. And I always tell everyone, man, unless you explicitly trust your manufacturer to the point of, you know, It's asking yourself, do I trust this person with $10,000? Is the bottom line.
Because once
you go into it, it's like because who's the one who's going to lose that money? Like you. You know, you get a big shipment full of stuff that when you take it out, something's wrong with it. They've delivered. Mm-hmm. You know, good luck trying to get money back from a factory. That'll never happen.
I told the factory
it's like the cheapest $150 you'll ever spend.
Yeah. Because
then you just have peace of mind. Because there's always things. And one thing I found too is that like you can get five different photos of something from a factory that all look different. Because there's different lighting, a different phone, a different this. We went back and forth over a shade of purple with a factory for 4 months once.
I'd be pissed.
Because it was ridiculous. The whole thing was done. And there's a little purple scribble on it. It's not even, it is literally a purple scribble. Mm-hmm. But they kept sending it to us and it'd be gray. And up to the point where I just went to like Michael's and bought a bunch of bottles of purple paint and packed them. I'm like, this color, just use this.
And then sent it. Yeah. And
mailed it to the factory with color swatches, with the PMS reference swatch. Like this is the color purple, and they take a photo. Sometimes it'd be kind of gray. Sometimes it'd be kind of purple. Sometimes it'd be something else, light, dark. Or they just use like the worst digital camera they could find.
Mm-hmm. You dropped this camera before you used it. What happened?
It looked like the original digital cameras, like those. Just horrid, old school, just pixel grainy. So yes, 100%, just pay the $150.
This guy, when I worked and I produced the Barfy figure, they
I love that. That's so fun.
I told him, I was like, okay, can I see pictures of the painted one? And he said, yeah. And so he sends them to me and we're back and forth. It's like 2 a.m. and I'm exhausted. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking over it and I was like, hey, that doesn't look right. Can you take it outside? And he was like, absolutely. And like went outside and took pictures again. And I said, that, I don't know what the hell's going on. Can you take it into a different lighting that's not outside or the first one? And he went into an office and he took another. And I was like, okay, great. That's the one.
And you're like, then that's right. But then it's like, which one are you getting? You know, because how did that camera white balance? Like, you know, is the office light more yellow tinted? Is it more blue tinted? Is it pure white? It's so wild. So hard. I mean,
I will have him send. I am going to have them send one of each painted variant to the artist. Actually, I'll do the background communication. But if you can okay the colors, then we'll move forward.
I find too, if you just supply a paint master. Did you do that?
We didn't supply one. We have photos of it and didn't supply the thing, but we have the color call outs and all that. And we're the hard part that we've learned too is that PMS codes or which I'm assuming is that like a version of Pantone?
PMS is Pantone matching system.
So that though the codes match, the chemicals don't.
Well, that's because Pantone is meant for print.
Right. So
and so when you're trying to Pantone like an item, it's just kind of like a closest guess. You know, if it was a print and they just type in the number, perfect.
So we sent I used the numbers and I used the numbers when I did the Furbzerker and we sent them off. And they came back and one of the colors was wild. And I was like, I don't know what color that is, dude. And they sent back the number and they said, oh, it's this number. And I was like, no, it's not. And we had like back and forth over emails about, and then it got narrowed down to, well, we do this process to make this color versus like we're trying to. And so they had to use another PMS code that looked crazy on my end. But when they made it, it looked like the color I wanted.
And that's just one of those weird, that's what I just call one of those weird factory things. Cause people assume, that I don't know. I think people assume that just like factory production is just easy and you just press a button and everything works out. And it's not, cause also, not only sometimes it does, but like sometimes you have a product that the factory is sourcing three different factories to get it, you know, so it might be cast in one place, painted in one place. If it has hair, it'd be hair punched one place. Then you get your packaging done one place. Then someplace just combines it all. So there's so many things, and there is always just like a weird, like, I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah.
Just a factory thing.
Tyler, you've given us some knowledge over the course of close to 2 hours.
I know. Can't believe we've been talking for 2 hours.
Yeah. I think the way that I want to finish this, and I think would be really good, what is your advice to people that are working in toys right now of what to do with the tariff stuff or to brace themselves, whatever that looks like? What is your advice with that?
Honestly, you know, it's hard to, I mean, I don't think anyone can say because it changes so quickly.
Yeah.
I honestly feel like they are going to make an exception for toys at some point here. Mm-hmm. I feel like toys will be carved out the same way phones are being carved out. I think it's just going to take a while because the world is just playing a game of chicken with itself. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's scary times. It is very scary times. Like, I mean, and I'm just talking scary it's toys and it's scary times. Like that's not even including like, you know, people's retirement accounts are being murdered here. You know, there's global tension, you know, but as far as on our little like small kind of supposed to be happy spot, I do feel like, especially when I take into consideration things like so many of those high dollar, high value supporters count on overseas manufacturing to fill their stores. I feel like it's just a matter of time before we kind of get that. It might not be, you know, might not go to zero tariff on toy. I mean, it isn't anyway. You know, it's usually, you know, 8%. There is always kind of a tariff on toys. But if you can sit tight, I can't see this.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't, because it's, again, you know, like the toy industry is big, but it's not huge. Isaac Larian, who's the CEO of MGA, kind of put it in comparison the other day, where he's like, the toy industry is $40 billion a year. And he goes, Apple sold $167 billion worth of phones just in America last year.
Yeah.
So the toy industry is big, but it's not huge. Mm-hmm. And so I just don't think it's one of those like top priority things.
Yeah.
But it'll get there. And I think a lot of people are just sitting tight right now, because again, like you can't predict any of this. You know, 250% tariff, like what's the next thing going to be? 500% tariffs? Like, just make it 1,000,000,000%.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, let's just blow it out. No one knows. But then, you know, there was 124% tariff on iPhones for a week.
Yeah.
That's gone. You know, there's a 120% tariff on automotive. It appears that that's going to be gone. So it'll work out. It's, you know, this is all just a giant chess game that unfortunately has millions and millions and millions of people are the potential sort of collateral damage here. But I haven't seen what is promising is that, again, I'm on LinkedIn. I know so many people in the toy industry. I'm not seeing people posting things, you know, like, there are no mass layoffs at Hasbro yet. There's no mass layoffs at Mattel yet. There's no mass layoffs at Lego or, you know, like Schilling or any. I'm not seeing those kind of doomsday harbingers yet.
Yeah.
So I think there's people who know more internal than I do that are probably hedging on the fact that things will sort of regulate there. But for now, there's probably only a dozen people who actually know what's going to happen, and I'm certainly not one of them.
Well, dude, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all the wisdom.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Of course.